Over the course of the weekend, God willing, we're going to look at the life of a number of different disciples, and I think one of the benefits of that is that, of course, all of these people were different. They had different characters and different personalities, and I suppose if we look around the room here today, we'll probably find that that's pretty much the same today, isn't it? We have tall people and short people and thick people and thin people, and we have quiet people and we have confident people, we have retiring people, but the funny thing is that we've all been called to a knowledge of the truth. And obviously what we learn from that is that despite the fact that we're all different, that God has seen fit to draw us into his purpose, because obviously he is able to make use of us for the advancing of his purpose in the earth. And so it was with the disciples of Christ, because here what happened is the Lord had chosen together men and women who were in fact exceedingly diverse one from the other, and yet he saw that they all had the potential to grow in the truth. And the key with all these people, with the exception of one of them of course that we're going to look at later on, is that they were all prepared to allow the truth to change them. And I think that's perhaps the greatest key to the life of all the disciples, that they were prepared to allow the truth to change them. That's the key, because what we're going to find is that they all had problems. None of them were perfect, but you see, if we're prepared to allow the truth to overcome our problems, then in fact we can become useful in the truth. And the lesson we're going to learn from the life of Judas was not that really his problems were any worse or any greater than anyone else's, but the real problem that Judas had was he wasn't prepared to allow the truth to change him. That's what made Judas different. And so we're going to find that hopefully by the time we've finished the studies, I hope that everyone here in this room will say, well, you know, I reckon I'm a bit like so and so. Well, that's good, because it's, I think, encouraging for any of us to feel that somewhere in the midst of the disciples that there was someone a bit like us. Fancy that person being there. I'm quite like them, and if they were called to the truth, well maybe there's hope for me after all. And I think, in fact, to be fair, we'd probably find out that at times we're a bit like all sorts of different disciples. Well, here's our first one, good old Peter. And of course we have to do Peter first, because Peter was always at the front of things, wasn't he? You know, it's a bit like that when you go to school. You know how there's always some kids that always have their hand up first with the answer? You know, I guess we've all had someone like that in our class. Maybe it was you, or maybe it was me in that class. That was Peter. He couldn't help himself. He just had a character that was enthusiastic and at times a little impetuous. Peter always wanted to put his foot out and jump and then look where he was actually jumping afterwards. That was Peter. That was the way he was made. There was nothing wrong with that. You see, one of the things we have to learn about all the disciples was, although they matured in the truth, they always remained who they were. Peter would never ever become Philip, and Philip would never ever become John. He would always be Philip, he would always be Andrew, but they were able to mature in the truth so that their personality could now be put to work for the best interests of the truth. So there was nothing wrong with Peter as a person, just that he had to have certain corners rubbed off him. And that's what we're going to look at in the course of this study. Well, in John chapter 13, the reason why we're starting in John 13, which seems a little bit late in the record, because we're now at the last night of the Lord's life, you think, well, there can't be much left to do with Peter now. We've got, of course, far too much material, haven't we, to cover in Peter's life. So all we've done is taken one night of his life, which is probably actually enough, because it happens to be the most important night of Peter's life, in which he was to learn the lesson, we believe, that would forever change him. And here in John 13, in verse 31, it says, when he was gone out, that's Judas, of course, Jesus says, now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified on him. You know, if you read this record carefully, you can just about sense the sigh of relief that Jesus breathed when Judas went out. Can you see that? Judas goes out, the door closes, and you can just about see the tension go out of the shoulders of Christ that Judas has gone. Now is the Son of Man glorified. He turns to the ones that are left and he says, verse 33, little children, yet a little while I am with you. You know, that was the only time Christ ever used that phrase. And he ever used it once. Little children. Who took that phrase up, by the way? John, of course, was to use that later on, wasn't he, in his epistles. And John never forgot that moment in the upper room. Never, ever forgot that. That was a tremendous, a very tender expression from Christ. Judas had gone, the tension was out of the story, and Jesus turns with a smile to those that were left, and he says, "My little children." It was a very tender expression, but do you know what it really means? I think that what Jesus was saying here in verse 33 was that it was expressing the inability of the disciples to stand alone without him. "You're only little children yet." So it was a tender expression, but a warning that they were not yet grown enough to stand quite alone without him. And so he goes on to say, verse 34, or perhaps verse 33, "Little children, yet a little while I'm with you, ye shall seek me, and as I said unto the Jews, whither I go, ye cannot come, so now I say to you, a new commandment I give unto you, that ye love one another, as I have loved you, that ye also love one another. By this shall all men know that ye are my disciples, if ye have love one to another." Now, what was the newness of the commandment in verse 34? Because the Old Testament said to love one another, to love one's neighbour as oneself. So how could Christ say that was a new commandment? Any thoughts on that? Yes. And I suppose the quality is, let's read it again. It's funny, you know, good Bible study, and I really believe this, good Bible study is all about good Bible reading, isn't it? More than anything else, more than textbooks and lexicons and concordances, it's about good Bible reading, and it's all in the way we read the story. So verse 34, "A new commandment I give unto you, that ye love one another as I have loved." That's what was new, wasn't it? There'd never ever been love like this before. Oh, there'd always been an Old Testament requirement for love. But they had never ever seen an example of loving one another such as has now and was now to be set before them on the next day. "That ye love one another as I have loved you." That was new. And that was the love of self-sacrifice for one another, wasn't it? "By this shall all men know," verse 35, "that ye are my disciples, if ye have loved one to another." They were to follow his example. Well, here's our friend Simon Peter in verse 36. "Simon Peter said unto him, Lord, whither goest thou? Jesus answered him, Whither I go, thou canst not follow me now, but thou shalt follow me afterwards." So Simon pops up and he says, "Look, where are you going, Lord?" Jesus, well, where was Jesus going? Well, he was, of course, going to the Father, but the way that he was going involved the way of sacrifice, didn't it? It involved the way of submission to his Father's will. It was a way that was going to involve the total surrender of his life in obedience to the Father. And so he says to Peter, he says, "Look, Peter, whither I go, thou canst not follow me now, but thou shalt follow me afterwards." Do you know, the word "follow" in that verse means to be in the same way with, or to accompany, especially as a disciple. To be in the same way with, or to accompany, especially as a disciple. Jesus says to Peter, look, he says, the way I'm going, which was the way of obedience and of sacrifice, he says, you can't come on that way now. You see that word "now," verse 36, Peter? "But thou shalt follow me afterwards." And the word "afterwards," by the way, means, it's the Greek word "husteron," and it means eventually. That is, at the last of all. So it doesn't just mean, oh, you'll follow me afterwards. In other words, first me and then you, Peter. It means you'll follow me eventually. In other words, not until Peter had reached a certain stage of maturity would he be able to follow Jesus in this particular way. And what would that be? What had to change in Peter before he could follow the Lord, to accompany him as a disciple? Well, once Peter had learnt to do the Father's will, in the same way that Christ had. And he hadn't learnt that yet. Now, the interesting thing about this story, you see, is that, you see, Peter felt that of all the disciples, that he was the most enthusiastic and the most loyal to Jesus. That if ever there was, you know, Peter says, look, I might have my problems, and I know I've got my problems, sometimes I speak up too much, but no one could ever doubt that I'm the most loyal of all the disciples to Jesus. And he was upset that Jesus had said, you can't follow me now, Peter. Oh, you'll follow later on, eventually, but not now. And so Peter, well, he wants to argue, verse 37. Peter said unto him, Lord, why cannot I follow thee now? Rather, him says, even now. Why can't I follow you even now, says Rotherhims. I will lay down my life for thy sake. Oh, now hang on a minute, Peter. that's pretty strong words, isn't it? I'll lay down my life for thy sake. That's being very dramatic, isn't it? You know, sometimes we say things about how terrific we're going to be in the truth and how loyal and what we're going to do that maybe we've chosen words that are just a bit big for what we're actually really going to be able to accomplish, and that's what Peter does here. And Jesus turns round to him in verse 38, and look at this. Jesus said, wilt thou lay down thy life for my sake? How do you think Jesus said that, by the way? How would you read verse 38? Jesus said, wilt thou lay down thy life for my sake? What mood do you think Jesus had there? How do you think Jesus said that? Was he sarcastic? Was he rebuking? How would you read verse 38? Yes, I think so. I think there was a mild, there was a definite challenge in what the Lord was saying. So you can just see this. Peter said, why can't I follow you even now? I'll lay down my life for thy sake. Jesus turns around and said, wilt thou lay down thy life for my sake? And then he turns around and he says, verily, verily, I say unto thee, the cock shall not crow till thou hast denied me thrice. And in verse 38, the word denied is a very strong word in the Greek, and it means not just to deny, but to utterly repudiate. Now that seems to be a very strong reaction of Jesus, you see. Peter says, look, he says, why can't I follow you even now? I'll lay down my life. Jesus turns around and he says, do you think that you will lay down your life? I'll tell you, Peter, before the cock crows three times, you will utterly deny me. And I can just see Jesus looking quite sternly at Peter. In fact, Peter was probably quite taken aback. Now, fancy the Lord speaking to him like that, of all people, me. And the Lord turns around and challenges me on the basis of my loyalty. Everyone knows, all of these people here know that I'm loyal to Christ. How could Christ do that to me? Well, you see, the key to all that is that verse 18 says, I know whom I have chosen. And you see, that's the key, you see, because the Lord knew all his disciples and he knew their weaknesses. And the Lord meant exactly what he said that night when he warned Peter that he would deny him, because he knew every one of his disciples inside out and he knew what Peter's problem was. And the problem was that Peter didn't know what his problem was. Now, you know, that's not so here we have the warning of Jesus until before the cock crow twice, thou shalt deny me three times. Now, that's the first time that Peter's warned by Jesus on this occasion, or the occasion of this. Whereabouts are we in John 13, by the way? We're at the Last Supper and we're in the upper room still, aren't we? Now, if you come to Luke chapter 22, we come to the next part of the story, because Luke chapter 22 now gives us the next part of the narrative whilst they're still in the upper room. So we're still in the upper room in Luke 22, but we've moved a little further on in time to the words that we've had in John 13. Now, in Luke 22 then, it says, in verse 28, ye are they which have continued with me in my temptations, And I appoint unto you a kingdom, as my Father has appointed unto me, that ye may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom, and sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And the Lord said, Simon, Simon, behold, Satan hath desired to have you, that he may sift you as wheat. So here we come now to the next episode, only a short while later, in the upper room. And you see that phrase, and the Lord said, in verse 31, most manuscripts actually don't have that phrase. It doesn't matter too much, because what's going to follow on is what the Lord said anyway, but it just seems to make it more abrupt if we take those words out. So the phrase, and the Lord said, is not in most manuscripts. And so what happens is, Jesus is talking to the disciples, and all of a sudden, it would appear, without warning, he turns round to Peter, all of a sudden, and says, well, you notice what he does say, because he doesn't call him Peter, does he? He says, Simon, Simon. Now, why do you think Jesus called Peter Simon? Any thoughts on that? Yes, because Simon means hearing. Yes, I agree with that. Anything else? I'll give you a clue to it. You don't need to turn it up, but just listen to these words. And he brought him to Jesus. This is Andrew bringing his brother to Jesus. And when he saw him, he said, Thou art Simon, the son of Jonah. Thou shalt be Cephas. That's John chapter 1, verse 42. Now, what does that tell us? Yes, Simon's his old name, isn't it? Yes, Simon is the man in his raw state, isn't he? Simon the son of Jonah. At the beginning, before he's matured, before he's developed. But Jesus, when he first saw him, said, he says, I know you. He says, you're Simon the son of Jonah. But you will be called Peter or Cephas. One day when you're grown up in the truth and you're mature, you will become the rock, but you're not there yet, you're still Simon. Now, how long has Peter been with Jesus now, by the time we get to Luke 22? He's been with Christ for 3.5 years. This is the end of the ministry of Christ, isn't it? He's been called Peter throughout the whole story, and on this last night, when he said, why can't I follow you now? Jesus turns around and he says, look, he says, before the cock crows, you'll deny me 3 times. And then a little later on, Jesus turns around and he looks at Peter and he says, Simon, Simon. Oh, that would have hurt, wouldn't it? Why is he calling me Simon again? That's the old man, isn't it? Not the new one. Simon's the undeveloped, the raw, the immature disciple. And what does he say? Verse 31. He says, Satan has desired to have you, that he may sift you as wheat. Now, you see, it doesn't quite show in the Greek here, but in the authorized version. But we've actually got to look for for the text here, which says, Satan has desired to have you, that he may sift you as wheat. But I have prayed for thee. And in the Greek of the text, the word you in verse 31 is in the plural, and the word thee, of course, in verse 32 is in the singular. Now, let me just explain what that means. If we just read it again, it reads, this is how it should read. Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has desired to have you all of you, all the disciples, but I've prayed for you, singular, Simon. See what the Lord was saying? Actually, there's a really good comment, you know, you need to take a note of this. Nazareth Revisited, page 453. Brother Roberts has a really good note on this particular moment. Satan has desired to have you all, that he may sift you as wheat, but I've prayed for you individually, Peter. Well, this is what Brother Roberts says in Nazareth Revisited about that phrase. Satan has... What do you think that means, by the way, before I read Robert Roberts? Satan has desired to have you. Now, remember how that whenever we're explaining to someone outside what Satan is, we say, well, the context always determines what Satan is, doesn't it? So who or what was the Satan, do you think, on this occasion? Sorry? Yes, that could be right, fleshly aspects of his life. But notice that it says Satan's desire to have all of them. So it wasn't just Peter. A testing time, yes. The rulers of the Jews. Oh, now we're getting more specific, yes. Well, that's pretty good actually. Was that Philip at the back there, was it? This is what Robert says in Nazareth Revisited. He says, Christ probably meant that the authorities who were plotting his destruction would try to corrupt the fidelity of the disciples one by one should Judas fail them, and that Peter would be in special danger from such a process. That's interesting, isn't it? Satan has desired to have all of you that he may sift you as wheat, but out of all of you disciples, Simon, I've prayed for you that your faith fail not. And when thou art converted, why did Christ pray for Peter? The most loyal, the most enthusiastic of all the disciples, why would Jesus say that Peter was the one in greatest danger of that process? And I'll tell you why. Now you've got to listen to this. Because what Peter thought was his greatest strength, his loyalty to Christ, was actually his greatest weakness. Because, you see, Peter's loyalty to Christ was based on confidence in his own abilities. It's just that Peter didn't realize that yet. He thought that was his greatest strength, his loyalty to Christ. Christ knew whom he'd chosen, and he knew that what Peter thought was his greatest strength was actually his greatest weakness, because it was all based on confidence in himself, not confidence in God. Peter thought, I can do it. Jesus knew he couldn't. And that of all the disciples, strangely enough, Peter was the one who was most at risk of the authorities being able to break him down. And so he says in verse 32, I've prayed for thee that thy faith fail not, and when thou art converted, strengthen thy brethren. Fancy saying to Peter, now Peter, when you're converted. Ooh, that would hurt, wouldn't it? Fancy saying that. Strengthen your brethren. And, well, we can imagine, if you were Peter, and knowing what Peter was like, how would you react to that? How would you react to the Lord turning around and having that little chat to you? Well, here's how Peter reacted in verse 33, just about how we'd expect him to react, being Peter. And he said to him, now, I think this is through clenched teeth, you see. Lord, I am ready. Now, what do you think the word ready means there? I've prayed for you, Peter, that your faith fails not. And when you've converted to the truth, Peter, you help strengthen the other disciples. And Peter says, look, he says, I am ready. Now, what does the word ready mean, do you think, in this context? I'm ready to go with thee both into prison and to death. Remember what's happened in John 13 as well, only a few minutes before. You see, Jesus said, Peter, you can't follow me now, but afterwards, eventually. Peter says, you're quite wrong, Christ. I am ready now. Isn't that what he's saying? He was absolutely certain that his loyalty to the truth could never be challenged, and he was very upset with what Christ had done on this occasion. That the Lord should see fit to warn him, you know, about this and to suggest that he might fail in that way. And therefore what he's suggesting, of course, is that the conversion that Jesus was talking about in verse 32 has already happened. When thou art converted, I'm already ready. Oh, he didn't like this at all, Peter, did he? And Jesus says in verse 34, and here it is for the second time, he said, I tell thee, Peter, the cock shall not crow this day before thou shalt thrice deny that thou knowest me. So you think you're loyal. I'll tell you what, he says, the very matter of your loyalty will be called in question this day. And you'll find that you're not as strong as you thought you were. Now that's twice the Lord has said that phrase in verse 34, isn't it? Before the cock shall crow, thou shalt thrice deny me. That's two times. Matthew chapter 26. The Lord actually said it three times. Fancy saying that three times to Peter on the one night. Imagine how Peter would have felt hearing that warning coming from Christ three times on the one night. Well, remember what happened when they had finished the time that they spent in the upper room. We're told in Matthew 26 and verse 30, it says, when they had sung an hymn, they went out into the Mount of Olives. And so they've left the upper room now, and they're on the way to the Garden of Gethsemane. And verse 31, then said Jesus unto them, all ye shall be offended because of me this night, for it is written, I will smite the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock shall be scattered abroad, but after I am risen again, I will go before you into Galilee. Peter answered and said unto him, you see, you can see Peter still smarting over what's gone on in the upper room. And he says, though all men shall be offended because of thee, yet will I never be offended. You know, you have to admire Peter in a way, can't you? He was really upset that Jesus had called into question his loyalty. So here's Peter again having another crack on the way to the garden. But you see how unwise, Peter was, because he says, though all shall be offended because of thee. Imagine that impact on the other disciples. So Peter says, look, they all should be offended, including this lot here. I will never be offended. Jesus said unto him, verse 34, verily I say unto thee, this night before the cock crow, thou shalt deny me thrice. That's three times now the Lord's warned Peter in that very phrase. Three times on the one night Peter was warned about that. You will deny me three times. Peter said, verse 35, though I should die with thee, yet will I not deny thee. Likewise said all the disciples. Of course, you know, they felt they had to really join in once Peter had been so strong. In fact, Mark's gospel record says in chapter 14 and verse 31, when he says the words of verse 35, but he spake the more vehemently. He spoke the more vehemently, saying, though I should die with thee, yet will I not deny thee. This is how the Diaglot translates verse 35. Who wrote the Diaglot, by the way? General knowledge. Who wrote the Diaglot? The Jehovah's Witnesses. Benjamin Wilson. Who was Benjamin Wilson? Was he an associate or a friend of others? Was he a Christadelphian? Sorry? He wasn't. It has been said that he was for a period of time, hasn't it? That he was at the Christadelphian. I know I mentioned that to someone, I remember mentioning that to a Jehovah's Witness, because they'd actually mentioned about the Diaglot, and I said, yes, it's quite a good translation. I realised it was written by a Christadelphian. And then they proceeded to talk about all the mistakes in the Diaglot. So the Diaglot translates, and by the way, there are mistakes in the Diaglot too, aren't there? So we have to be careful. But this is how the Diaglot translates verse 35. Peter said unto him, if it may behove me with thee to die, not thee I will deny. It's actually a double negative. If it may behove me with thee to die, not thee will I deny. You see, he was very upset that Jesus had called into question the matter of his loyalty. In fact, by the way, I think this explains the whole matter of the sword in the garden, because who whips out a sword in the garden a few minutes later? Up comes poor old Malchus, and Peter's got one. Remember they said, Lord, here are two swords? Well, obviously one of them was Peter's. And Peter's in the garden breathing fire and smoke that the Lord should question his loyalty, and all these guards and soldiers come. Right, so the Lord thinks I'm not loyal, does he? Right, I'll show him. Out comes the sword, whack, whack, and off goes Malchus's ear spinning to the ground, because Peter was upset. You see how that all fits properly, doesn't it? because Peter's upset that night that Jesus has called into question his loyalty, and out comes his sword. Flash, flash, fine, swash, but I'll show the Lord who's loyal. But Mark says, and by the way, only Mark says this, I'm pretty sure this is right, that finally they all forsook him and fled, didn't they? And you know, by the way, who was the guiding influence behind the Gospel of Mark? The Gospel of Mark was inspired by Peter, wasn't it? That's another story, we can't go into that now. It was written by Mark, but we believe that the Gospel of Mark was narrated to Mark by Peter. And interestingly enough, it's in Mark's Gospel that the record just quietly adds a little phrase, and they all forsook him and fled. Can you imagine Peter saying that as he writes this story later on? Oh, how humble he would be that after all these professions of loyalty that they'd all run away, including him. But at least he came back, didn't he, that night? He must have felt bad, because at least Peter came back. Now, where did he come back? He came back to watch what was going on. Now, come and have a look at John chapter 19. Just a couple of interesting things in John chapter 19 as we see what actually therefore went on in this story. It's not John 19, it's John 18. I just want to pick up one verse in John 18, and then we're going to go and see what he actually said that night. It says in verse 18, John 18, verse 18, and the servants and officers stood there who had made a fire of coals, for it was cold, and they warmed themselves, and Peter stood with them and warmed himself. You see that phrase, Peter stood with them. Do you know that's the very same phrase used of Judas in verse 5? And Judas also, which betrayed him, stood with them. Oh, fancy that. The very phrase now that's used to describe the betrayer himself, Judas. And it's now taken up in the life of Peter. And Peter stood with them. Not the same way, of course, because he wasn't standing with them in the way that Judas did, but there's something dangerously close here between the two that night, isn't there? One man betrayed his Lord that night, and the other man came very close to following in the same steps. Very close. And Peter made a very bad mistake that night, because you see what verse 18 says? It says that they'd made a fire of coals. I want you to take a note of that phrase and just tuck it away, file it away in your memory for a minute. They'd made a fire of coals. And so what had happened was, you see, Peter had tiptoed back in into the shadows to see, at least he wanted to see what was happening in the judgment hall. If he could just see through the window at the back there, he could see what was going on. Wanted to keep in the shadows, but he felt bad that he'd run away, didn't he? And so he said, I want to be there. And then they lit this fire, and it was a very cold night, and Peter thought, well maybe I could, you know, mingle with the crowd and just edge forward a bit and get a bit of the warmth. But he forgot that flames not only warm, they also give life. And the light flickered into the face of this man, and a maid passing by saw the face in the firelight. She said, I know that face. And Mark 14 tells us what happened as he made the fatal mistake of stepping forward into the light. He should never have done that. And so we're told in verse 66 of Mark chapter 14, and as Peter was beneath in the palace, there cometh one of the maids of the high priest, and when she saw Peter warming himself, she looked upon him and said, and thou also wast with Jesus of Nazareth. But he denied, saying, I know not, neither understand I what thou sayest. And he went out into the porch, and the cock crew. So you see, Peter was there watching the Lord on trial. But there were actually two men on trial that night, weren't there? And Peter was on trial as well. And the problem is that this had been a very bad night for Peter. He'd been told off three times by Christ that he would deny him. He'd been told off in the Garden of Gethsemane about going to sleep. He'd been told off in the garden about using his sword. He was cold, he was hungry, he was tired, he was upset, and he was bewildered. And now someone said, and you were with Jesus of Nazareth. That wasn't a good time for Peter to make a stand for the truth, was it? His defences were all at the lowest ebb that night. And that's the moment when the trial struck. And there were two men on trial that night. One in the palace, one out of the palace. And here's the one out of the palace, verse 68, but he denied, saying, I know not, neither understand I what thou sayest. And you see what he did? Better get back into the darkness. He went out into the porch. Blow, I've been seen. Melted back into the darkness a little further away from the light of the fire. But if you compare all the records, you'll find that one of the problems is that it sounds like two maids had a chat together. One inside passed the message to one outside. See that gap over there? I reckon he was one of the disciples of that bloke. And the verse 69 says, a maid saw him again and began to say that to them that stood by, oh, this is one of them. You can just, you ever heard a ripple going around a room of a little conversation spreading? And then what happens once it spreads? Eyes start to turn and you feel uncomfortable. You feel a prickle at the back of your neck. People are looking. People are watching. Ever felt like that? They're all watching me. Ever felt like that? That's exactly, Peter really felt under pressure here. And they said, this is one of them, verse 70, and he denied it again. But Matthew 26, verse 71 adds, with an oath, saying, I do not know the man. And a little after verse 70, they that stood by said again to Peter, surely thou art one of them, for thou art a Galilean, and thy speech agreeth thereto. And John adds a phrase that only John has. He says, that a kinsman of Malchus said, didn't I see you in the garden? Oh! Now, Peter would really feel, you'd feel under pressure, wouldn't you? A kinsman of Malchus. Didn't I see you with something in your hand? And verse 71 says that Peter the disciple all of a sudden became Simon the fisherman. And he began to curse and swear. All the old fisherman's oaths came pouring out of his mouth. And he began to curse and to swear, saying, I know not this man of whom you speak. And the second time the cock crew, and Peter called to mind the words that Jesus said unto him before the cock crowed twice, thou shalt deny me thrice. And when he thought thereon, he wept. And in a moment of time, he'd found that what he thought was his strength, his loyalty to Christ, had fallen flat on its face, because it was all based on confidence in himself. And that night, his own confidence had been badly battered. Now, of course, Luke adds something that Mark doesn't, because something else happened at that precise moment of time. And only Luke tells us, of course, what happened. And this was the worst thing of all, because Luke chapter 22 tells us that at that same time as the cock crew, and the Lord and Jesus thought about the words of the Lord, about what he'd said, well, Luke 22 says in verse 60, and Peter said, man, I know not what thou sayest. And immediately, while he yet spake, the cock crew. And verse 61 says, and the Lord turned and looked upon Peter. And the word looked there means to observe fixedly. So through the window, Peter's observing the trial of Jesus, and Jesus is in there being tried and under a trial for his own stand concerning the truth. And all of a sudden the cock crows, the sounding of the chains of the watch. And through the window, Jesus, in the midst of his trial, suddenly turned around and looked out through the window straight at Peter. Now, what sort of look do you think that was? Describe the look to me. Sadness? Hurt? I think Peter could have probably borne both those things. We certainly don't, it wouldn't have been triumph, wouldn't it? You can't imagine Jesus saying, you see, Peter, told you so. No, you wouldn't imagine Jesus doing that, would you? It was a very special moment, this. You know, I tell you what, I guarantee Peter never ever forgot that look. Never ever ever would he forget that look. And I think you think you're quite right, it would be sadness, wouldn't it? And sorrow. But you know what else it would have been? Yes. And understanding. Peter, I understand. Can you feel that in the eyes of Christ? I know, I realise, Peter. Don't worry, I understand. Now, if you were Peter, could you have stood the look of Christ on that occasion? You'd rather that someone looked at you accusingly, wouldn't you? Or that someone said, well, there you are, you see. But to have the look of a man who had sadness, but also a warm compassion that says, it's all right, Peter, I understand. No wonder the record says, in verse 62, Peter went out and wept bitterly. And the grown man went out into the shadows and bent over the ground and wept long, salty tears in the knowledge that his Lord had been right all along. And you see what verse 61 says, and Peter remembered the words that the Lord had said. You know, the word remembered there is the Greek word hupomnesis, which means to recall to memory. It flashed back into his mind what the Lord had said. Do you know that the greatest thing in the truth is to try and recall scriptural principles at the time we need them rather than afterwards. See, it was too late, wasn't it, to remember what the Lord had said now, because he's already fallen. The greatest challenge of the truth is to try and remember scriptural principles so that we can recall them when the problem arises, not afterwards. Now you see, there's a turning point in Peter's life this night, isn't there? A real turning point. Because what the Lord had shown him was that it's no good to have confidence in the truth based upon your own abilities, because your own abilities will inevitably let you down. You might not think that, and it's especially hard when we're young. Because we feel sure that we're loyal to the truth, and we feel sure that we can do it. But time and circumstance and experience suddenly places us in situations when we find that we can't do it. And Peter had to learn that. It wasn't that he oughtn't to be loyal to the truth, but that his loyalty had to be built on confidence that God can do it, but not me. That was his problem. It's not me that can do it. But I believe God can through me, if I learn to trust in him. Not many of us have had a look like that. And I'm sure that if we'd received it through the window, we wouldn't have forgotten it either. Now, come and have a look at John chapter 21. All right, so remember the story of John 21 when they all went fishing, they were waiting for Christ, and they caught nothing, and they heard this man say in verse 5, standing on the shore, they're out there having labored all night, they caught nothing, and they hear this voice from a stranger on the shore saying, children, have you any meat? And they call back across the water, no! And then he says, cast your net on the right side of the ship and you shall find. And they cast therefore, and now they were not able to draw for the multitude of fishes. Alright, so remember the story of John 21 when they all went fishing, they were waiting for Christ, and they caught nothing, and they heard this man say in verse 5, standing on the shore, they're out there having labored all night, they caught nothing, and they hear this voice from a stranger on the shore saying, children, have you any meat? And they call back across the water, no! And then he says, cast your net on the right side of the ship and you shall find. And they cast therefore, and now they were not able to draw for the multitude of fishes. And verse 7 says, therefore that disciple whom Jesus loved said unto Peter, it's the Lord. Now when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he girt his fisher's coat under him, for he was naked, and then cast himself into the... Does that sound like Peter? Good old Peter. You know, it was John that figured out who it was, but it's Peter that leaps over the side of the ship, and away he goes, fast into shore, because he wanted to be the first to be with Christ again. But you see what happened when he got there, verse 9. And as soon then as they were come to land, here's Peter, guess what he sees? Ooh, hoo, hoo. A fire of coals You know, the only other time that phrase is used is in chapter 18, verse 18, when he warmed himself at the fire. And Peter walks up, all dripping wet in front of Christ, standing on the beach, and looks into the fire again. But this time it's Jesus standing there watching him. And Peter was about to go on trial. But this time it was going to be with Christ, of course, not with the authorities. Same phrase, only time the phrase is used. Anthraxia is the Greek word. Fire of coals in chapter 18, verse 18, and here in chapter 21, verse 9. Jesus said, verse 12, "Come and dine." And so they did. And when they had dined, verse 15, Jesus said, now, you all know this little story, but you see now how it all has power on the basis of what has gone in the background of the previous night. So you see, when they dined, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of Jonas." Now you see, he deliberately uses that again, doesn't he? Because you see, Peter was saying all along, "I'm Peter, I'm Peter, I'm ready." Jesus says, "No, you're not. You're Simon, and you're not ready." And by the time that Peter's been through the last night's experiences, he now knows the wisdom of what the Lord said, and that there's no room for confidence in one's own abilities. And so when they dined, and by the way, I'm sure this conversation probably took place a little privately, perhaps just a wee way off, Jesus says, "Come with me, Peter." Now, Simon, son of Jonah, and he gently reminds Peter that there is still development to take place. Now you see what he says, verse 15, "Lovest thou me more than these?" What's the "more than these," you think? But isn't this the man who said just the previous night, "Though all these should be offended, yet will I never be offended"? Isn't that what Peter said? Hadn't Peter claimed to have a loyalty better than any of the other disciples? And so now the first question is, "Simon, son of Jonah, do you have an agape love for me, a really sacrificial love for me, more than all these? Because that's what you promised." And what does Peter say in return? "Yea, Lord, thou knowest that I have an affection for you." Now, why does Peter use philia and not agape in his reply? Because he now knows, that's right, that even though he'd said, "I will die for thee," that he couldn't really do that. And he now knows, and this is the lesson of the difference between the agape and philia. Has everyone got that marked in, by the way? Has everyone got those two different words marked in? Hands up those that have or that knew about that, to make sure that everyone really did. Right. Okay, there might be just one or two that don't. So, of course, the key here is that the word love is different in verses 15, 16 and 17. So I'm just going to translate the first word, agape, as sacrificial love, and the second word, philia, as affection. And so what Peter's learning here by giving the reply that uses philia is he realises now that one can only profess loyalty to Christ to the extent that we have actually developed in the truth. And we must learn not to profess loyalty beyond that. Well, Jesus says, verse 15, "Simon, son of Jonas, do you have a sacrificial love for me more than these?" He said unto him, "Yea, Lord, thou knowest that I have an affection for thee." He says unto him, "Feed my lambs." He says unto him the second time, "Simon, son of Jonah, forget about all these others then. Do you have a sacrificial love for me?" "Yea, Lord, thou knowest that I have an affection for you. Feed my sheep." He says unto him the third time, "Simon, son of Jonah." Now what's this? "Do you even have an affection for me?" Peter was grieved.
Because he said unto him the third time, do you have an affection for him? And he said, Lord, thou knowest all things. Thou knowest that I have an affection for you.
And Jesus said, feed my sheep. Which of course is really the same, by the way, as saying, when thou art converted, strengthen thy brethren, isn't it? That's the same idea. Verily, verily, I say unto thee, when thou wast young, thou girdest thyself and walkest whither thou wouldest. But when thou shalt be old, thou shalt stretch forth thy hands, and another shall gird thee and carry thee whither thou wouldest not. This spake he, signifying by what death he should glorify God. And so the man who had professed loyalty to the point of death would ultimately seal his life and death, but only when he'd matured. Now you see the lovely balance that there is in this story. How many times does Jesus say to Peter that he would deny him? He tells him that three times that night, doesn't he? How many times does Peter deny him that night? Three times in the palace or outside the palace. He denies his association with Christ. And now, of course, in John 21, three times Jesus makes Peter confess that. There's a lovely fullness to that story, isn't there? The whole thing has got to be... And you know what happened? You know, because of that, because the Lord had warned him three times, and because Peter had let himself down three times, you know what happens when they get to this episode here? Can you imagine that the first time when Jesus said, Simon, son of Jonas, do you have a sacrificial love for me more than these? You can imagine Peter saying, yes, I have an affection for you. And the moment Jesus said the second time, do you have a sacrificial love? Guess what? Peter knew it was coming a third time, didn't he? He had to know that. It was in the fitness of things that should be. He knew that this had to be worked out now three times. Three times Jesus had to question his heart on that matter. But what he didn't know was that the third time he was going to change the word. And the third time, Simon, son of Jonas, here I come again, third time. I've deserved this. Do you even have an affection for me? There was a purging here, wasn't there, of confession. Had to be done that way. And look at this phrase here. End of verse 19. And when he had spoken this, Jesus said unto him, now Peter, follow me. Now where did that come from? Well, I'm sure that first of all, Peter's mind went back to the previous night. You canst not follow me now, Peter, but thou shalt follow me afterwards. And now that he's been through this experience whereby he's learnt not to trust in the flesh, Jesus turns to him the next day and he says, well, Peter, follow me. But it takes him back further than that, doesn't it? You know what that word took him back to? It took him back 3.5 years to the shores of a sunlit lake with the nets slapping in the water on the sand, and a man walking down the beach whom they already met once and been amazed at the power of this man. 3.5 years before, Peter had been standing on a beach and this same man walked up to him and said, follow me and I will make you fishers of men. And that's what Peter's mind went back to. It was as if 3.5 years had disappeared. But now in John 21, Peter knows that he's ready to follow Jesus in a way that he certainly wasn't 3.5 years before. And so the lesson, I suppose, of Peter's life is learning to overcome the spirit of impetuosity and of confidence in one's own abilities. Let me have a look at the second of Peter and the first chapter of the second epistle of Peter. It says in verse 12, first, second of Peter chapter 1 verse 12, wherefore I will not be negligent to put you always in remembrance of these things, though ye know them, and be established in the present truth. You see the word established there?
That word is the same word translated in Luke 22, verse 22, when thou art converted, strengthen thy brethren. Strike so. To establish or confirm. So he says, I know that you are strengthened now in the present truth. Why? Because, well, that's what Peter's work had been in writing these epistles, to strengthen the brethren of Christ. I know that you've been strengthened in these things, he says, yet I think it meet, verse 13, as long as I'm in this tabernacle to stir you up by putting you in remembrance. And that word remembrance there is the same word translated in Luke chapter 22 when it says, and the Lord turned and looked on Peter, and Peter remembered the words that the Lord had spoken. Same word here. Peter says it's terribly important to get to know the principles of the truth so that we can recall them to memory at any time. Don't be like me. This is what he's saying. Don't be like me. I recalled the principles too late. I remembered what I ought to have remembered about faithfulness too late that night. Don't be like me. He says, you recall them to memory on time, at the right time. You know, isn't it true? It's funny, you know. We're all a bit like this, aren't we? That we all believe we're Christadelphians and we know the truth and we love the truth. But you see, the real test is when the moment of trial comes. And you know what? Sometimes, when we've got a problem in life, the principles of the truth go out the window, don't they? You say, oh, well, it's all right. You know, I might be a Christadelphian, but I've got a problem here to solve. Might be a problem at work, or a problem at school, whatever. It's pressure from a person, or pressure of a deadline, or pressure of something we've been asked to do that we don't want to do. Whatever it is. And somehow the last thing that we think about is, are there any divine principles that should affect what I do here? That's the last thing we think about. Peter says, don't be like that. He says, you've got to be strengthened in the truth so that you can bring these things to memory at the vital time to make the right decision, because I didn't. Verse 14, knowing that shortly I must put off this my tabernacle, even as our Lord Jesus Christ hath showed me. Where did Jesus show Peter that he must put off his tabernacle? John 21. When thou shalt be old, another shall gird thee and carry thee forth whither thou wouldst not. This he spake signifying by what death he should glorify God. And so from John 21 onwards, Peter knew that he always would seal his life for the truth by death, because the Lord had showed him that one day he would put off his tabernacle. And verse 15, moreover I will endeavour that ye may after my decease to have these things always in remembrance. And this time the word remembrance is a different word. The word remembrance here means a memorial or sepulchral monument, an epitaph on a tombstone. Peter says, I'll be happy even when I die if on my tombstone it says that I strengthen the brethren to be able to recall the right principles of the truth when they need it in time of trial. If I can have that engraved on my tombstone, I'll be a happy man, he says. So that's what Christ asked me to do once I was converted. And to learn the lesson that if we're confident in ourselves, our own abilities will inevitably let us down. That loyalty in the truth is based on trust in God and not in ourselves, and learning to appreciate the experiences of life that is able to bring that lesson to bear upon us. So I think we'll leave it there in terms of the story of Peter, and break for morning tea before we come and look at another man who is really quite different, the man called John. Thank you.